The United States has just moved past Germany as the world's leading supplier of wind energy. Wind turbine companies are focusing on the U.S., a rapidly growing market, but there is a downside to this energy alternative. Those swirling blades have been known to kill migratory bats. Every fall, some species of migratory bats fly from Canada down south for the winter, but not all of them make it. A wind installation in southern Alberta on a plains just east of the Rockies, that installation stands in their path, and each wind turbine there can take out several dozen bats a year during this migration season. And there are others like this all over North America. But now the energy company that runs the Alberta wind farm has teamed up with a local university to see if there isn't a way to spare some of those bats from death on their way to the Mexican holiday. And they came up with what could be a pretty good strategy for wind farms around the world. Research that appears in the latest issue of the Journal of Wildlife Management. Joining me now to talk about this is Robert Barkley. He is professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at the University of Calgary in Alberta. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much, Ira.
Seems like you had a pretty simple solution.
Seems simple after the fact, but of course these things are pretty complicated. And when we first started with this issue 4 or 5 years ago, it was a complete surprise that migratory bats would have an issue with wind turbines. Mm. As many listeners might know, that the issue was one involving birds rather than bats.
And then they thought about bats later. And simply your solution is to turn down or slow the blades down when it's downtime.
Well,
nighttime.
Of course, the bats are migrating strictly at night, so it's an issue of them running afoul of the wind turbines at night. And they're pretty small animals, so they don't like to fly when it's really windy, which, of course, is when you're generating most of the electricity. And so TransAlta and the other companies we worked with said, well, we know that there's not a lot of bat activity when it's really windy. Most of it's when the wind speed is low. What if we tweaked the operation of the turbines so that they don't rotate as much when the wind is low? We're not generating a lot of electricity anyway. Perhaps that will reduce fatalities.
All right, we're going to take a break and come back and talk more with Robert Barkley about reducing fatalities of bats in wind turbines. I'm Ira Flatow. You're listening to Science Friday from NPR News, talking with Robert Barkley, professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at the University of Calgary in Alberta, Canada. He was talking about a novel, actually. Why didn't anybody think of this before? Solution to saving bats at night when the wind is not blowing harder than when the bats are migrating. Just turn down the rotation of the wind turbines.
Well, and to be honest, when we started with this, we weren't sure whether the bats, like many birds, run into things, and they were running into wind turbines, and it wasn't necessarily that they were actually being hit by the blades. Mm-hmm. And as it turned out, many of them aren't actually hit by the blades, and yet they still die because they are near the turbines.
Well, wait, let's stop there and explain that. How do they die if they don't smack into the blades?
It turns out that the blades of wind turbines, like the wings of aeroplanes and the wings of bats and birds, create low-pressure areas of air around them when air flows over them. So as the blades turn, particularly near the tips of the blades, there are these
little vortex?
There's a vortex, and that vortex has low air pressure in
right.
it. And when a bat goes through that, the lower pressure is very sudden, and that means that the air in the lungs, expands rapidly and causes damage to the lungs.
Why doesn't that happen with birds?
Birds have a very different respiratory system. Their lungs essentially are stronger and can withstand that sudden drop in air pressure. And so when we were looking for bats and birds underneath wind turbines, we'd frequently come across bats that looked perfectly intact, absolutely nothing wrong with them on the outside. When we looked inside, turns out that their lung cavities were full of blood, and the little blood vessels in the lungs had been damaged. We never find birds that look like that.
Mm-hmm. You state in your research paper that when you did try your scheme of turning down the speed of the blades at the time the birds were migrating at nighttime, that the wind farm revenues went down $3,000 to $4,000 Canadian dollars per month of the study. Do you think companies are willing to lose money like that?
Well, it's obviously a cost-benefit analysis they have to go through. And that was $3,000 to $4,000 for 15 wind turbines, so it wasn't per turbine. So on a per-turbine basis, it starts to look economically not too bad. Now, obviously, the economics of wind energy is different in different localities, and it's a competitive market. They have to compete with other types of electrical generation systems. Mm-hmm. But it's an industry that depends on a green image, a low environmental impact. Mm-hmm. And obviously companies have to assess the costs of killing bats and birds versus the mm-hmm. costs of perhaps reducing that through this technique.
Do you think that other companies could make use of these operational changes that you've done?
Absolutely. There are similar experiments going on in the U.S. as we speak with similar results. And it's not that a particular type of turbine or a particular location necessarily this is going to work better at than others. As I said, bats are small animals. They simply can't fly very well when it's really windy. They fly mostly when the wind is low. And so if you start the turbine blades turning only when the wind reaches a higher velocity,
right,
then the bats can get through the wind farms without running afoul of the turning blades.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. John in Missouri. Hi, John. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello. Nice to be on the air. Yeah, I just had the comment that a lot of detractors of wind energy always use the whole bird-bat dying scenario to kind of say that wind power is not a viable option when they don't ever also say or compare how many birds have or bats or fish or all the other animals that have been killed by coal-fired power plants in the form of mercury poisoning or other type of contaminants. So, and I work in the renewable energy industry, and every time this bird-bat thing comes up, it just makes me roll my eyes because I think it's such a small number that it's not that big a deal as far as I'm concerned.
Professor Barkley?
Well, of course, it's difficult to compare the environmental impacts of different types of electrical generation. But absolutely, coal-fired generators, we have lots of them out here in Western Canada, they have different environmental impacts, and you're sort of trying to compare apples and oranges.
Mm. Thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255. Some tweets coming in from Twitter. This one reflects a lot of different same idea tweets from Plomo Media, who says, "Bats use echolocation, so attach something that makes sound to the propellers. Bats will teach each other to avoid the sound."
Yeah, and that was one of the first suggestions that came up, and the industry would love to have a little whistle or something that people couldn't hear, but bats could. Bats have very different hearing than we do. And the bat biologists around the table sort of thought about it and said, you know, we can't think of a sound we've ever produced that scared bats away. It always seems to attract them.
Really?
There just don't seem to be that many sounds that bats might be afraid of. That being said, there is a group in the U.S. that's trying to produce very loud but ultrasonic, in other words, above our hearing range sounds, that might interfere with bats' echolocation abilities, basically make it harder for them to detect the sort of echoes that they're interested in. And if that's the case, they might avoid those sort of areas.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could put that sort of sound generation around wind turbines, it might mean that the bats go elsewhere
right
during their migratory flights.
Michael in California, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Yes, hi. My question is regarding the newer design of the helix-shaped windmill. I had heard that it was better for birds. Is that true? And also, is it better for bats as well? Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good question, and I honestly don't know of any studies that have looked at that style of wind turbine from a bat perspective. The little, what used to be called egg beater, sort of vertical axis wind turbines went out of fashion. There are some newer designs coming online, but I don't know of any studies that have looked at the impact on birds or bats.
So where do you go now? What kind of studying will you be following up with?
Well, there are other ways, of course, to reduce the impact of wind farms on both bats and birds. And one of them is to try to figure out where the bats are migrating. What are the landmarks they're using? We don't suspect that there's just this wave of them crossing the entire continent. If we can figure out what routes they use, then we may have some options as to where to put or where not to put future wind farms. Mm. It doesn't help the ones that are up now, and that's why solutions such as the one that we looked at before are important. But sighting of wind farms may be another avenue to explore.
Yeah. How far do the bats migrate?
Great question, and I wish we knew. We have absolutely no idea how far north they come from and where they go.
Really?
So that there are three species that are the primary victims in this. They all migrate south. They spend the summers in Canada and the northern U.S., but we don't know where they go for the winter or what specific routes they take to get there.
You mean we've never tagged them and like we do other animals and follow them around? We know the butterflies, where they go.
Well, we know the butterflies, we know the birds, and people have been studying that migratory behavior for decades. Bats are pretty hard to study. They're hard to follow. They're pretty small, so you can't put on the sort of transmitters that you can on a grizzly bear, for example. And people simply haven't spent much effort trying to figure this out. Mm-hmm. Now here we have sort of more impetus to try to figure that out, and hopefully technology will allow us to do so.
And they're also not good public relations. They're not the cuddly little things that birds are.
Well, they're cute and cuddlier than most people think if they got a look at them. But you're right. They have a poor public image.
Yeah.
And despite the fact that they are the major consumers of nighttime insects and probably worth millions of dollars to farmers and foresters, they don't have the same image that butterflies or birds do. You're right.
They can come over and eat my mosquitoes anytime.
Well, and they do a good job on that. Lots of my neighbors like the bats around because they don't have many mosquitoes after that.
There you go. Thank you, Dr. Barkley.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
You're welcome. Robert Barkley is professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at the University of Calgary. Of course, that's in Alberta, Canada.
The U.S. Chamber of Commerce bills itself as the voice of business, but when it comes to climate change, business no longer speaks with one voice. This week, Apple announced it's quitting the chamber. It joins a handful of other high-profile defectors, as NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
In a letter addressed to the Chamber of Commerce president, Apple said it supports government regulation of greenhouse gases, adding it's frustrating to find the chamber at odds with us in this effort. The chamber opposed the cap-and-trade climate bill that passed the House earlier this year. It also fought against the EPA's recent effort to regulate greenhouse gases. Apple said it would prefer the chamber take what it calls a more progressive stance on climate change. Since it would not, Apple decided its course was to resign its membership immediately. A company spokeswoman declined to comment, but Pete Altman of the Natural Resources Defense Council called it an embarrassing rebuke for the chamber to lose Apple.
This is a company that is seen as an innovator, that is seen as a company that really can see around the next corner and figure out where they need to be. And I think that for a company like Apple to leave the chamber really underscores the fact that the chamber is way behind the curve here.
In a similar move, Nike announced it's quitting the chamber's board of directors, although not its basic membership. And three big utilities, PG&E, Exelon, and PNM Resources, have said they're dropping out of the chamber altogether in protest of its climate change position. Some of the defections may reflect these companies' own business interests. Utilities that rely heavily on nuclear power or that have made big investments in alternative energy could profit from a cap-and-trade system. New Mexico-based PNM Resources still gets most of its electricity from coal-fired power plants, but PNM spokesman Don Brown says his company supported the House bill and was disappointed when the chamber opposed it.
We've been a member of the chamber for 8 years. We had hoped to work within the chamber to influence other members and influence the chamber's position itself, but it became clear to us over time that that wasn't going to happen.
The Chamber of Commerce didn't return NPR's phone calls today, but in a statement last week said it does support strong federal legislation to address climate change. The chamber said it opposed the House bill because it's not comprehensive and doesn't include a binding international agreement. The chamber still boasts some 3 million members and a powerful checkbook. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, the chamber spent nearly $92 million on lobbying last year alone. Little wonder, then, that supporters of climate change legislation are making the most of the chamber's recent losses. Hari Savugan of the Democratic National Committee issued a press release this week trumpeting the departure of the iPhone and iPod maker under the headline, "I Quit."
At times, the chamber holds a very antiquated, outdated view of business.
Some businesses may support climate change legislation because it helps their bottom line. Others because it's part of their marketing strategy. And still others because they feel some kind of regulation is inevitable, and they'd like the predictability that comes from getting it over with. Pete Altman at the Natural Resources Defense Council says the chamber's high-profile defections will make a difference.
The chamber has lost its voice on this issue. When the chamber goes into an office now, the staff and the members are going to know that the U.S. Chamber is not speaking for the entire business community.
And that could be important as the debate over climate change moves to the Senate. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Time now for our video pick of the week. Flora Lichtman, our video producer, is here. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
What have you got for us this week?
This week, we go out west to California.
Oh, wrong west, sorry.
to the Richmond Field Station, which is part of Berkeley, and we see a mini meandering river.
A mini? How long did it take you to come up with a mini meandering river?
I didn't even come up with it. It's all true.
I saw the video. It's on our website at sciencefriday.com. The video up on the left side. And when you see it, you think it's a big river, right?
This is the most amazing thing. I mean, it really is, I think, pretty neat. So what I learned from these researchers, which Christian Broderick and Bill Dietrich are both geomorphologists out there, is that rivers, this type of river, the meandering river, which is the river you see from the airplane.
Mississippi, all that kind of stuff.
It's the curvy one, right? Basically. One channel curves, okay?
It meanders.
It meanders. But they're always to scale. So if you make a tiny one or you look at a big one from far away, like a satellite image, they look exactly the same. They're indistinguishable.
Wow.
It's really pretty neat.
So they proved this by making a little mini meandering river in their laboratory.
Well, this was already known, but what researchers have been trying to do for the last 100 years is to create this very common geological feature in the lab, and it's been really hard. I mean, they said, you know, it's so common, you think you could just turn on some water, put it in a sandbox, and you'd get a meandering river, but no.
No. So it's interesting what they were using for the riverbed, the river sides. The vegetation on the side is what did they use?
This might be the best part of this story. I love this part of the story. So the trick to making this meandering river was planting vegetation, like a
right.
real riverbank.
Sure.
And so they used alfalfa sprouts.
Oh, sprouts. That's California.
That's right. And apparently they're really fickle. So Christian Broderick said that, you know, he loves them and hates them because just they're difficult to
To you have to be a gardener, not only an engineer, a river engineer. You have to know how to plant the sprouts.
Yeah, he's become sort of an alfalfa sprout expert. You have to replant them all the time, apparently.
Right. So in the video you have up there, you've interviewed them, and we see how they actually create. It's not, as you say, it's not easy to make a meandering river. How long is the river?
The sandbox that they do it in is like almost 50 feet long. It's huge. But you see it step by step. So you carve out this channel and then you turn on the water. And, you know, I think the whole process takes months and months, actually.
And they had to discover the right kind of sand, right, to put in their river.
Yeah, it's not just any kind of sand. You need coarse sediment and fine sediment, all these sort of this combination, yeah. the recipe is really key to getting this to work.
And what's interesting, as you say about this, is once you get it right, you can't distinguish it, this 50-foot river from the 500-mile river.
That's right.
It looks like if you take a satellite picture, as you're saying, it shrinks it down, and then it's like the same size as the laboratory.
I think it's worth looking at just for that, because it really is kind of like an optical illusion.
Yeah, all right. That's Flora Lichtman with our video pick of the week. Go to sciencefriday.com and see. We haven't got a name, Meandering River. The
recipe for a recipe. River.
Maybe we'll have a – tell us what you think we should call
it. If someone can come up with a good title for this, please, we'll change it.
Right on the website. Just send us what you think. Watch it. There are comments on the bottom. What should we call it? Take me down to the river or something like that.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
That's about all the time we have for today. Our program is produced by Christopher Intagliata, senior producer, Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora is our producer for digital media. Laura Pelcher, our site. Arts producer, Shelley Du Bois, our Spanish language producer, and Neil Rausch, our technical director, and sitting there at the controls here in New York. We had help in Second Life from Lynn Cullins, Dave Andrews, Jeff Corbin, and the University of Denver. If you want to see, as I say, Flora's video pick of the week, give us a name for that river. Crimea River? No. These are all taken already. Go to sciencefriday.com and take a look at the video and put a name in down there. We'll see who comes up with the winner. Also, we're podcasting and tweeting and be on there all week. So you can stay in touch all week long. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
We're back with All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. A few days ago, I was on the edge of the Potomac River in Maryland, coating my pants with insect repellent.
Stay off, bugs.
I was following John Kress, he's a botanist at the Smithsonian Institution, through a dense forest of tulip poplars, maple trees, and spice bush. We were on our way to an obscure little island just a few miles upstream from Washington, D.C., It's called Plumber's Island, and it's the place where the quest to sequence the DNA of every single plant species on Earth began.
Sorry, a little overgrown.
After about 15 minutes, we stop at the edge of the Potomac. The water is low, and the channel separating the mainland from Plumber's Island is just a few feet wide. So John Kress leads the way as we scamper over some rocks and onto the island.
So here we are at the Welcome to Plumber's Island sign, the most thoroughly studied island in North America.
And that is a fact.
This is a fact.
The most thoroughly studied island in North America.
There's been more biologists out here looking at everything from worms to flowers to birds to mammals to snails than any other spot on the East Coast.
All on these 12 acres.
All on these 12 acres.
It's a strange little island, peaceful, serene, isolated, and yet it sits directly under the flight path from Dulles Airport and right below the busy Capitol Beltway. John Kress comes here at least once a month. Now, much of his research on plant life has taken him to more exotic places like Burma and Ecuador, places with far more biodiversity than Plumber's Island. But it's here, on this tiny little patch of land in Maryland, where a microclimate creates an unusual environment.
You think of the temperate zone, the mid-Atlantic forest with oaks and maples and things. What we're standing right now, we're surrounded by tropical plants. The pawpaws are in the tropical family Annonaceae. The spice bush is in the tropical family, the Lauraceae or the laurels. And so when I look at here, I feel like I'm in Costa Rica sometimes because it's just the sorts of things I'd see if I was in a lowland tropical forest in Central America. Of course, the big trees are not really tropical. They're the oaks, they're the maples, they're the walnuts. But when I'm here, particularly in the heat of the summer, it really feels like the tropics.
Are these native to this area?
They're native. In fact, the pawpaws are probably also fruiting right now. We might find some pawpaw fruits around.
Can you eat it?
You can eat it. They're good.
Kress leads me up a narrow path to the highest point on the island. At the top sits an old ramshackle wood cabin. The cabin is the clubhouse for a super exclusive fraternity called the Washington Biologists Field Club. It's been around for about 100 years, and membership is strictly limited. There are only 65 spots. And even with his distinguished record of research, John Kress didn't get in until 10 years ago.
As members pass on, we have new members, younger members.
So you can't expand?
We've never expanded.
Right. So in order to become a member, somebody has to pass away.
Or leave the area and resign their membership, which is rare.
So this has got to be one of the toughest clubs in the city to get into.
I'm probably not going to comment on that.
The members are the stewards of the island. They actually owned it until a few years ago when they donated it to the federal government. Outside the cabin, Kress fills me in on a project that could potentially revolutionize the way we understand plants.
What we were doing on Plummer's Island was using it as a pilot study for something we want to take to the tropics and take to forests all around the world, which is developing a system of identification based upon the DNA of a species. This DNA marker we call a DNA barcode, and that's essentially taking a small segment of DNA that we can find in all organisms. We have to locate it on a certain part of the genome, but it's variable enough that it's different for all species on the planet. And then we can take any sort of part of a plant, or take a hair or a leg of a grasshopper, grind it up, get out the DNA, sequence this little chunk of DNA, and then tell what species that is.
The barcode he's talking about isn't a literal barcode like a UPC symbol on a cereal box. It's a code that's inside the plant.
The DNA is inside the trees, inside the plants, and we extract that DNA, and then we have to sequence that DNA to actually identify the plant. So we're not there yet in terms of me picking a leaf off the ground and telling you immediately from its DNA barcode what that is. We would have to take it back to the lab,
right. Sequence
it. But technology is heading in the direction where we expect what now sits on the top of a desk as a DNA sequencer will eventually fit in the palm of your hand.
So like an iPhone or
like
something?
Like an iPhone, cell phone.
Within a few years, John Kress imagines kids wandering through forests around the world with portable scanners that could analyze a sample of any plant, check it against the DNA database he's creating, and know within a few seconds what species they're looking at. But to get closer to that future, we have to get off the island and into the lab. So we drive about 30 minutes to Suitland, Maryland, home of the Smithsonian Museum Support Center. It's a giant campus where the Smithsonian stores all the stuff you don't see in the museums. And it also hosts dozens of research labs.
The affectionate name for the Museum Support Center is the Death Star.
The scientists call it the Death Star because it's one of the cleanest places you've ever seen. Spotless.
Okay, everybody sign in. I just need a photo ID.
We're here to meet Kress's partner in the DNA barcoding project. His name's Dave Erickson. Dave is the guy who collects all the plant samples sent to him from around the world, including the samples collected on Plummer's Island.
And we take literally two hole punches out, and that's the source of all the DNA that we'll use.
Two hole punches.
And that is more than enough DNA to do all the sequencing we're going to use. In fact, it's so much DNA that we can preserve that for whole genome sequencing down the future if we get to that.
Once the samples come in, Erickson grinds them up and sends them to a DNA extractor. Eventually, the plant's DNA is analyzed and the data from the specific gene is converted into that DNA barcode. And that barcode is what goes into the DNA database at the center.
Anybody who wants to go to Plummer's Island, or in theory, as we extend this to all plants, anywhere, collect a plant in any kind of forensic context, the technology for extracting the DNA and sequencing that is ubiquitous. So let's say there's a kid in a hospital, he's sick, he barfs up some stuff, they can recover that fragment of leaf tissue that he ate, do a DNA extraction. Because we have a reference library at this defined set of genes, they know exactly what gene they need to target and sequence. Once they do that, they can figure out what this kid ate. Okay, so the power of the reference library is that it's the same gene. Everybody knows what it is. It's easy to recover in a lot of different environments and contexts.
Similar plant species might have very important differences, like one strain might be poisonous and one might not be. Right now, when scientists need to distinguish between two different species of plants, plants that might appear identical to the naked eye, they have to wait until those plants produce fruits or flowers, and that could take up to half a year. Back on Plumber's Island, John Kress says that future, when people will know instantly what plant they're looking at, is still a bit far away. There are literally millions of plant species to sequence, and then thousands more yet to be discovered. But at least here, on these 12 acres in the middle of the Potomac, the job is complete.
It's pretty amazing to walk through here and know that we have a DNA barcode for every plant that's out here.
Every single thing.
Everything.
If you'd like to see photos of Plumber's Island and the lab at the Smithsonian's Museum Support Center, visit our website at npr.org.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Writer Michael Pollan famously advises, eat food, not too much, mostly plants, and don't buy foods you've seen advertised on TV. And that's just the kernel of his ideas about the American food industry and American agriculture in his enormously popular books, including his latest, In Defense of Food. Last month, the University of Wisconsin-Madison gave that book to all incoming freshmen and urged professors to discuss it in class, which, as you might suspect, set off a Donnybrook in a heavily agricultural state. A lot of farmers challenge Pollan's work as a direct attack on them and how they work. Some ideas of his may be appealing, they say, but unrealistic. Others, just ill-informed. Today we'll talk with Michael Pollan and with two working farmers who deal every day with the practices that he criticizes. Later in the program, Farhad Manju of Slate on the international fishing ring broken up by the FBI and his practical ideas on how to protect our terrible passwords. But first, the omnivores debate, and we'd like to hear from farmers today. If you're familiar with Pollan's critique, is it accurate? Are his proposed solutions practical? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. And Michael Pollan joins us now from the studios on the campus at the University of California at Berkeley. And nice to have you back on the program.
Thanks, Neil. Good to be back.
And remind us, if you would, the critique of American farmers.
How much time do you have?
Well, in a capsule, if you could.
Let me start, though, by alluding to something you said in your setup, because I don't think it was true. You said I was critical of American farmers. Now, some farmers have taken what I say that way. But in fact, I kind of defy anyone to find things I've actually written that are critical of farmers. I am critical of various practices, and I'm very critical of a system, a set of incentives that really forces farmers to plant monocultures and to consolidate and get bigger, and leaves them with very few choices in the way of either markets to sell their products or ways to grow them. And that's very different than saying you're critical of farmers. It really is a system that I'm critical of. And it's a system that's been designed by other people, and is the result of the kind of farm policies we have in our country.
So farmers themselves, that's
an important distinction.
Farmers themselves have few choices.
Well, very often they do. If you're growing corn and soybeans in the Midwest, you know, there's one buyer of your products. That's the grain elevator in town. If you want to, as farmers have told me, if you want to try to do something else, if you want to grow some broccoli or some tomatoes, you run into all sorts of problems. The first is that under the farm policies, you lose your subsidies as soon as you get out of corn and bean land. The second is, who's going to buy your food? So there are many farmers who are interested in changing what they're doing, who see that growing lots of corn and soy doesn't really work that well for them either. I mean, that farm income has been falling. We had a spike last year. And that this system doesn't really serve their interests either. But it's important to understand that there is a counteroffensive underway right now from the agribusiness lobby. And that is trying to depict this critique. And it's not just my critique. It's the critique in Food Inc. and Eric Schlosser's work and a whole lot of other people as an attack on farmers. And that is the agribusiness hiding behind farmers, as far as I can tell.
How can you – well, you've explained that the people are forced into this. Some of these farmers – why don't we bring a farmer on to speak for himself, all right? Let's bring another voice into the conversation. Blake Hurst is a farmer in northwest Missouri with six other family members. He grows corn and soybeans on 4,500 acres there. His family also raised cattle for many years. They don't do that anymore, though. He recently wrote an article for the Journal of the American Enterprise Institute called The Omnivore's Delusion Against the Agri-Intellectuals, and among them Michael Pollan. And he joins us from the studios of NET Radio in Lincoln, Nebraska. And it's good to have you on the program. Thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And do you have choices in what you do and how you do it?
Well, certainly I do. The road goes right by my house. I can get on it and leave at any time. I can put different products on it and sell them at any time. I choose to grow corn and soybeans because that's – which, first off, I challenge the monoculture. Corn's grass. Soybeans are a legume. We rotate them year after year. That allows us to not use – you know, we use absolutely no insecticides because different insects attack different crops. So first off, I believe I'm in a monoculture. My friends in southern Missouri grow rice, wheat, cotton, corn, and soybeans. So they have lots of variety in the things they grow. But I'm not trapped at all. This is a free society. I choose to do what I'm doing. I'm proud to be doing it, and I enjoy it.
And when you read Michael Pollan's work, I read your article, and you said he's depicting you and other farmers as being, well, either dupes of commercial interests or, well, not so bright.
Well, yeah. I mean, he says the agribusiness is hiding behind me. Like when I wrote the article, Monsanto was in the room with me. I mean, you know, my wife helped me sound out some of the big words, but other than that, I did it all on my own, and I'm not a tool of anybody.
And the other farmers that you know and other people in your district, they're doing the things that they are doing, presumably, because that's the best way to make a living?
Yeah. And farming is a competitive industry. And whether I'm raising broccoli or corn or soybeans, the profits that come back to me will always be the level of profit that the marginal last farmer is willing to accept. So it tends to be a competitive business. Yes, I wish I received more for my grain. Yes, I wish my income was higher. But I enjoy what I do, and clearly if my income was not high enough, I'd get another job.
Michael Pollan, as you look at the statements by Mr. Hurst and others, I don't think he's part of he did write for a conservative journal, but is he part of this concerted attack you're talking about?
Oh, I don't know that. I can't say whether Blake is writing as an individual for himself or is part of something larger than that. Obviously, I don't question his motives in writing that piece at all. I'm just saying that what's going on around the country right now and the efforts to silence my speeches on college campuses where there are agribusiness interests involved, which is happening, you know. As you said, in Madison, there was a lot of protest, and in
That was after handing out the book to every student, every freshman is hardly
right.
Muzzling you.
The Farm Bureau in Wisconsin had a big problem and it was very interesting what happened there. They bussed in several hundred farmers, all wearing green T-shirts that said "In Defense of Farmers," and they were expecting to hear. A very different Michael Pollan, I think, than they actually heard. Because when they left, they were surprised that what I said didn't conform to what the Farm Bureau was telling them I said, mm-hmm. Which is to say I was talking about how to build new agricultural markets so that they could diversify. I was talking about figuring out ways to get more of the consumer's food dollar into their pockets. Right now, 90% of the consumer's food dollar goes to middlemen, processors, marketers. And that in the kinds of alternative agriculture that we're beginning to talk about in this country, there are great opportunities for farmers. And I think a lot of farmers, whether they take those opportunities or not, the fact that there are now these new markets, whether it's for organic or pasture-raised livestock or, farmers market food or all these other kinds of things, these are great opportunities for farmers who had less choices in the past. And you know, when the farmers left that hall, they were kind of surprised. And I talked to some ag journalists who said, yeah, we were on the bus with them going back, and they said they really didn't find as much to disagree with in what you said than they expected. And so I think that there is something of a caricature being drawn here.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. You know, the other thing I want to say is that I really welcome this debate that's getting started. You know, it is long overdue. And Blake is definitely part of that, and he wrote a really cogent, powerful contribution to that debate, and he raised some really good critiques of alternative agriculture, which is to say, do we have enough farmers to do it? Will it be productive enough? Will we be able to make food? Will we be able to change without raising the price of food? These are really key questions for the alternative food movement, and he honed right in on them. And there are no easy answers. But having this political debate about where farming and food are going in this country is exactly what we need, and I'm delighted to see it being joined.
Blake Hurst, could there? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I want to. You know, I think that reading a lot of the comments and stuff on the web about my article, it's clear I did not do one thing very well, and that is, as the old joke goes, some of my best friends are organic farmers.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I am absolutely let a thousand flowers bloom. We grow flowers on our farm. I actually sell them at the farm. I sell directly to the consumer. I think it's wonderful. There's new markets and new kinds of food being raised, and I it's fun for us to leave the farm and go to a restaurant where someone's cooking something different than we might receive at home. But the point I would make is that there are environmental costs to turning our back on technology. That, I guess that was the point of my article. In other words, we farm no-till farming, which we were only able to do because of chemicals or because of pesticides that we use. And that cuts our erosion probably down to 20% of what it was 30 years ago when I began farming. Now, we may choose to move away from technology, and the consumer is going to make that decision in the final analysis. But she needs to know, the consumer needs to know, that there's environmental costs to farming as the critics of farming would have us to do.
Well, I guess I would just say to that is, I assume when you talk about no-till farming, are you talking about using Roundup ready crops?
So yeah, we do, although you can do it without mm-hmm. them. But yeah, we use Roundup ready beans, not corn, but beans.
And it is absolutely true that Roundup Ready soy has helped with erosion in the Middle West. There was a huge problem with soil just disappearing from our farms. But it's very important that even when you point to an achievement, and that is, in my view, the one achievement of Roundup Ready soy, that you take a clear-eyed view of the costs of these technologies, because there really are trade-offs. The high productivity of American agriculture has had costs, environmental costs, pollution costs, the amount of nitrogen that washes off of fields that ends up in the Mississippi and creates a dead zone in the Gulf that's now the size of Massachusetts. So, you know, there are achievements and there are costs.
We're going to have to resume after a short break. The music means we're coming up on a post. So, gentlemen, stay with us. Michael Pollan, the author of most recently In Defense of Food, and Blake Hurst, who farms corn and soybeans on 4,500 acres with six other members of his family in northwest Missouri. Both of you stay with us, please. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Most of us can agree that we should eat healthier, lots of vegetables and fresh produce, fewer processed foods. The debate is in the details, where we get our food, who produces it, and how. Is it practical to eat only fresh local foods grown organically? We'd like to hear from farmers today. Are these proposed solutions practical for you? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Our guests are Michael Pollan, a young reader's edition of The Omnivore's Dilemma, will be published next week. And Blake Hurst farms 4,500 acres with his family in northwest Missouri. He wrote the opinion piece, The Omnivore's Delusion, against the agri-intellectuals for the July issue of the Journal of the American Enterprise Institute. Let's get a caller on the line. And Adam is calling us from Rodelia in Kentucky. I hope I'm pronouncing that right.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, I'm a farmer. This is my third year. I'm actually considered a young farmer, even though I'm 29, on a a beef cattle farm that's been in the family for quite a while, and I just started diversifying into vegetables and mushrooms as well as pastured poultry, and we're now grass finishing our beef, all for direct marketing and sale through CSA and farmers markets.
I'm sorry, what's the CSA?
The CSA is a program where members pay, they're paid up front for a season of vegetables where they get a delivery each week, where I raise over 40 different vegetables.
And, so that sounds very local then.
It is. It's the idea is that it really connects the customer, the consumer, to their food because they understand what's in season and when it's available. And so my comment is really just about the differences that's being made between organic and conventional farming is that organic has a much higher cost and that it's not as productive necessarily. And I just kind of have a definitely don't believe that that's true with animal agriculture because I've seen with our finishing our animals on grass that we have a much lower input, and that's through fossil fuels and making hay. If we're able to finish our animals on pasture that we keep the animals on year round, and I think that's true with the chickens as well. The chickens are able to consume 25 to 30% of their needs, their nutritional needs out of the grass, clover, and insects that they find on the pasture. So that, again, brings our feed costs down. And I think that's kind of a myth that organic agriculture is not really productive or efficient because it actually uses natural systems and biological systems to enhance its productivity, and that's not taken into account at all in our conventional view of agriculture.
Adam, when we go to the store, if they sell organic produce or organically raised meats, as you do, they're always more expensive.
Well, yeah, they're not subsidized by the federal government as most of the food, and also the processors and the grain buyers and all these things are subsidized by our taxpayer money, and that's not the case with organic food. It's actually
more
in line with the true cost of food is going to be.
The true cost, so we're paying not paying enough, in other words.
Yeah, I mean, I'm taking a lot of what Michael said already, you know, that this is, we don't have any idea what food actually costs in terms of not just labor, but actual inputs and money, and that's well off base with what the rest of the world actually understands how their food is made and what it actually takes.
Let me ask Blake Hurst about the role of subsidies in the economics of your farm.
We accept subsidies, involved in farm programs. I would point out for the last several years they have played a very small part in our income, play almost no part in the decisions we make. Last year, my total direct farm payments were about 3% of my gross sales. I'm not sure that they changed the price of grain very much, that they affected the decisions I made. Well, I'm positive they didn't affect the decisions I made on the farm. I would point out that everyone talks about local sales and local farming, and we need to remember that not all of us are able to have sell directly to the consumer within a 30-mile radius of my farm. There's probably only 6,000 people. It's almost impossible for me to have the kind of relationship with the consumer that the caller is talking about. So that's a very good thing for people who live near urban areas, and mm-hmm. and I commend them for it. But for those of us that live where I do, what I raise is going to have to get on a truck and go to the city. It's just almost impossible for it to be consumed in any other way.
Michael Pollan, are the subsidies a big part of the conversation?
Yeah, subsidies are a big part of the conversation. You know, in Blake's case, the fact that he received so little last year probably reflects the fact that grain prices were at record levels. If you go to Iowa in an average year, though, farm income is about 40% government payments. So it is for most, commodity farmers in the Middle West, a big part of the equation. And I think it does limit their freedom of operation. And, you know, whether that is driving down the cost of grain is a very complicated question. I mean, a lot of people argue that even if you got rid of them, grain prices would still be low and keep falling because farmers have a lot of incentives to overproduce.
Okay. Well, I mean, I interject. I mean, in Mr. Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, he seems to be lamenting the changes in farm policy that happened in the late 80s and early 90s. In other words, before then, there was the government literally set the price. Now the government, the market clears. The government does not set a floor under the cost of our – or the cost. So I think Mr. Pollan is correct. I mean, I think, and most farmers would disagree with me, but I think he is correct. I think that farm subsidies, the way they are now, probably do make the price of grain lower than it would be without them. Less variable. Our incomes are less variable. And yes, indeed, in low-price years, a larger part of our income comes from farm subsidies. But I think he's right about that. I have no disagreement. I don't think that we want to go back to where we were in the 1970s. There was huge amounts of problems caused by those programs as well.
Well, that's true. But, you know, we're going to scare people off by talking about farm subsidies.
Yeah, we are. Mostly me.
All right, Neil, move on.
All right. I wanted to thank Adam for his phone call and introduce another farmer on the program. Troy Rausch farms corn and soybeans on 6,000 acres in central Indiana, also vice president of the American Corn Growers Association. He joins us from the studios of member station WFYI in Indianapolis, and we know you've gone to some effort to be with us today. We appreciate it.
Hi, Neil. Thanks.
And I know you've been listening to the conversation as well. Are the kinds of things we're talking about practical to kinds of things Michael Pollan's talking about practical for farmers to do?
Well, practical in what sense? The big question, and both Michael and Neil alluded to this.
Blake, so I'm
Blake,
not the farmer.
I'm sorry. You're Neil.
I was born with a black thumb. I grow nothing.
Blake alluded to this, is whether or not we can, in fact, feed an ever-growing population in a post-peak oil world. And that perhaps is the big question.
And how does that impact how you farm on your farm?
We've, in the last couple of years, become very cognizant of energy cost because it drives a lot of our input cost, namely fertilizer. And, you know, we manage that as best we can. But as we look at this going forward, you know, we're starting to ask questions. What's going to happen when oil returns to $100, $150 a barrel? How are we going to manage that on our farm and be profitable?
And the questions are hard to answer, aren't they?
No, they're very difficult to answer. Therefore, that's what I find so intriguing about Michael's book is this discussion of cover crops and widening out our rotations and utilizing animal manures and such to try to get away from the more industrial type of farming that we now do.
Are you planting half your ground to legumes every year and raising corn the next year?
I'm experimenting. I'm learning. Working with a lot of cover crops. It's a difficult process, and it's a learning
because
process.
Because that restores nitrogen to the soil and reduces the amount of fertilizer you'd have to use the following year.
Yeah, but the problem is that our growing season does not allow us to grow a cover crop from the time one year is harvested till we plant the next year. So we have to grow the cover crop so we don't grow corn for a year, grow a cover crop, and then come back with corn, which is the way, of course, my grandfather farmed in the 30s. And he would take hay off of the cover crop to feed his cattle. And the problem is that doesn't provide as much nitrogen as my crop needs, and I lose income for a year. So I'm using twice as much labor and twice as much water and twice as much land to raise the same amount of corn. And so there's environmental cost to all, and plus, of course, I'm tilling the ground four or five times both years, where in the system I use now, I'm not tilling it at all. So there's erosion costs, there's land costs, there's water costs, and there's labor costs. Mm. Against that, 3% of the United States nitrogen, or 3% of our energy goes into making nitrogen for crops. So it's a very small part of our energy use.
Let's get Josie on the line. Josie's calling us from Boise.
Yes, hi. I want to say how honored I am to be on this show.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you to say.
I am an organic farmer in Boise, Idaho. I'm lucky enough to be a urban farmer. My husband and I farm 33 acres within the city limits, and this year we're expanding to a 60-acre model so that we can put it into rest and paddocks systems, just like we've read in The Omnivore's Dilemma. And so it's such an honor for us to have people like Michael Pollan writing books about exactly how we farm.
And as you say, this is a very small farm and an urban farm. And are the principles that he endorses easier for you because of that?
I think it's easy because I am 6 miles away from downtown Boise. So I don't have to use any days to truck my food into the city. Also, I'm very accessible to the community, so I can teach classes and have dinners. I can have greenhouse sales, which really help. But my husband and I have tried to run our whole farm in the black with no loans. And right before the show came on, we were having a heated discussion about a new barn. And I don't think we can afford the whole barn this year. And he doesn't think that we should just build half a barn.
Huh.
And so I said, you know, can we just put the posts where maybe it's going to be built? And I think farmers, no matter what type of crop they're growing, commodity, organic, diverse, CSA, it's a tough row to hoe. There's not much money in farming, no matter how you're growing or what you're growing.
I think you can get universal agreement on that. I just have to ask one quick question, Josie. Do you make, is this your principal source of income?
This is our principal source of income. We're very lucky to have this be our principal source of income. This is our 7th year. We run a CSA farm with other different markets. We grow about 120 types of vegetables, herbs, fruits, flowers, and pastured poultry that we run then through our cover crop. And we're figuring it out without taking out loans. And it feels really good to not have debt like I know a lot of my large farming friends have.
Well, Josie, thanks very much for the call. Good luck to you, and I hope you get the whole barn built.
I hope so, too. Thanks so much.
Neil, could I jump in?
I just want to say one thing, that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, no, I think it's very interesting to hear this conversation and listen to Blake talk about the challenges of extending his rotations and the experiments that I know Troy is doing on his farm. The fact is, that's what we need, is this spirit of innovation. And we need to build a safety net under farmers so they can do it. What Troy said is exactly right. We are going to need to be able to learn how to farm without so much fossil fuel. We're going to have to learn how to use the sun again. It doesn't mean turning back the clock. It means coming up with a broader definition of technology. A really ingenious rotation for the Midwest represents exactly the kind of technology we need. It's just as sophisticated as a Roundup Ready seed. And, you know, if you go to Argentina, they have a very interesting rotation. They do an 8-year rotation. They'll do 5 years of cattle on grass. They'll rotate them around their pastures, and then they'll do 3 years of grain. And they find if they do that, there's so much fertility in the soil, they don't need to use any nitrogen for 3 years of grain. They also don't need any herbicides. You know, that means putting animals back on farms. That's a radical change from where we are. But this is the kind of work that you know, ingenious farmers like Blake and Troy and the woman who just called will be figuring out, and hopefully they'll get a little help from the agricultural schools.
Go ahead, Blake.
Well, I mean, the nitrogen problem is a problem. I mean, that is the problem. That is the question. I mean, where does the nitrogen come from? Those cows don't produce nitrogen out of the air. The only nitrogen they can leave on the ground is what they take from their diet. And so how can they grow 3 years of corn without adding nitrogen? Well, either there's been, I don't know. I mean, are they growing enough legumes in their rotation to get nitrogen for 3 years? I don't know. I mean, I it's not going to work on my farm. I'm not sure of that because we tried it.
But I did want to ask if that future that Troy was talking about, where oil goes to $100, $150 a gallon again, a barrel, excuse me, again, if that is indeed our future, and some people believe it is, what's that going to do to your costs?
Well, it's going to make them higher, which means the food costs are going to have to go up. But Mr. Pollan in his book quotes another book about nitrogen and says 40% of the world people that are alive today in the world are there because of the ability to synthesize nitrogen from the air using energy. We have to have the nitrogen. We can't get it any other way if we're going to feed the population we have today or the 50% increase in population that we're looking at over the next 50 years. That's the only, I mean, there is no other answer. And we're rich in America, and we can experiment, and we may choose to do things differently. But most of the world is going to have commercial nitrogen in order to feed their population.
Hmm. Well, I think it is. Go ahead, Troy.
Just got a minute left, so go ahead.
Sure. I think we've got to step back and take a look at this nitrogen question. And the first question we perhaps should ask is, do we as American farmers need to be producing 13 billion bushels of corn? We're feeding corn to cattle. That's not necessarily the prudent thing to be doing. What Michael proposes is we put these cattle back on the pastures.
And Michael, we'll give you 30 seconds for the last word.
Well, you know, nitrogen is the big question, but I would not give up on the idea that we can figure out systems, ecological systems, to feed ourselves. We don't know the answer. We don't know for sure we can feed the world more sustainably, but we sure are going to have to try.
Interesting questions that all of you raise, and it's interesting to me that, indeed, there's a lot of the same questions being asked in different ways by all of you. Thank you all very much for your time today. Michael Pollan is the author of In Defense of Food, and this week a young reader's edition of The Omnivore's Dilemma is going to be published. We thank him for his time. And Blake Hurst, who farms corn and soybean on 4,500 acres with six other members of his family in northwest Missouri, joined us today from NET Radio in Lincoln, Nebraska. And Troy Rausch, who farms corn and soybean on 6,000 acres in central Indiana and is vice president of the American Corn Growers Association at the members studios of member station WFYI in Indianapolis. Both of them went way out of their way to join us today. We thank them so much for their time.